So today, we celebrate the transfiguration of the Lord, which, if you were at all paying attention during the gospel, you know exactly what we're talking about. Jesus called up to his disciples and said, "Hey, you three, come with me." They go up to a mountaintop. Jesus is there praying. And then all of a sudden, frankly, the unthinkable happens. Now, if you've been in church for any length of time, you've heard this story before. And I think that kind of sets us back. I teach a senior level Bible class that's a dual enrollment class, so some of the kids actually get college credit for taking this. And one of the things that I continually say to them is, you know, you probably, if you've been in church since you were, you know, wee little things, you've heard some of these stories since you were, you know, seeing them on flannel boards and you know, had little dolls acting them out in your Sunday school classes. And they lose the thoroughly strangeness of it all. There is something thoroughly and completely, entirely bizarre about this that we lose because we've heard it so many times. This is one of the only feasts in the church year that we celebrate twice. We do this on the last Sunday before Epiphany, or excuse me, the last Sunday after Epiphany, the last Sunday before Lent begins. And then we celebrate it August 6th-ish. We're celebrating it on Sunday this year. So we celebrate this twice. And it's one of those where we hear it so often, we don't think about how just crazy it had to be. So Jesus often said, "Hey, I want to go pray quietly by myself. Let's go pray." Okay. Let's leave behind the multitudes and go pray. All right, let's do that. "Hey, no, not all 12, just you three." Yeah, even that wasn't so odd. Let's go. So they get up there by themselves. Jesus starts to pray. And then the glory of God descends upon the mountain. Now, this really hasn't happened, I don't know, maybe about 1,400 years, you know, since Moses went up on the mountain and the glory of God descended and he, you know, gave him the Ten Commandments. That was really the last time that the glory of God descended. That's what this whole cloud descending on the mountain really harkens back to. And if you're a Jew who's listening to this story, hey, Jesus went up on the mountain and all of a sudden they're surrounded by this cloud. The Jew hearing the story is like, "Oh my, okay." And then Elijah's there and Moses is there. And I've said this before, but I always wonder, were they wearing name tags or something? You know, "Hello, my name is Moses." Did he have like a big beard and the turban and the staff? And was there a little puddle of water and he just tapped it and it parted? And he was like, "Oh, Moses." You know? I suppose Elijah would have been a little bit easier to, you know, camel hair, big leather belt. Clearly he's not John the Baptist because we know John the Baptist, but John the Baptist kind of took after Elijah, so he's not Elijah, must be John the Baptist. Other way around. But, you know, how did these guys know who these people were? You know, was Jesus like, "Moses, Elijah, Shalom"? Things I wonder about during my sermon prep time. But the real question at that point, and the reason we call it the Transfiguration, is all of a sudden, Jesus doesn't look like everybody's been seeing him. He doesn't look like just a guy. He is transfigured. He is metamorphosed. He is shining and white and full of glory. He actually looks exactly like John sees him when he has his vision of heaven when he's in exile on the island of Patmos. He turns around and there's Jesus. And you have to think that John, in exile, 60 years after the transfiguration, had to go, "I remember you." What a moment that had to be for him. But the real question is why? Okay, yeah, sure. Other versions, other gospels talk about Moses and Elijah talking about what was to come in Jerusalem, and that Moses and Elijah were talking about how Jesus was going to die, and they were sort of preparing him for what was to come, encouraging him. But Mark's gospel doesn't talk about that at all. It says they were there. And really, even if Moses and Elijah were talking to him about who knows what, maybe the best way to celebrate the Last Supper, I don't know. You know, I imagine Moses had a really good handle on how to do Passover. But, yeah, that one takes a while. You'll figure it out soon. But that still doesn't explain why God showed those three apostles what that vision of Jesus looked like. Why is that? And I think the key to that is in our Old Testament reading. And to that, you have to go to a passage that normally is read on Good Friday. But really, because of the way we do Good Friday, we don't ever talk about it. Because the way we observe Good Friday, we break up our meditations into the last sayings of Jesus. But this passage is alternatively called the testing of Abraham or the binding of Isaac. And that's the Old Testament reading on Good Friday. And this is the passage where, it's from Genesis 22, if you want to go there. This is the passage where God says, "Hey, I want you to take your son, you know, your only son, your beloved son, and take him up to this mountain and kill him. Because I say so. Because I'm your God." Sounds like a pretty rotten thing to do. Okay. So he takes a couple of his men, he takes his son, takes all the wood, the big knife, the oil, all the things necessary for a sacrifice, except, you know, an animal to kill. And he goes up to the mountain, and he gets to the point where he just needs to go a little bit further, and he tells his men, "You guys stay behind, the boy and I'll go ahead." And they keep on going. And, you know, then, you know, Isaac probably having that, you know, "Hey, I got a bad feeling about this" kind of thing, says, "Look, here's the fire and there's the wood, but where's the lamb for the offering?" And Abraham probably just being deceitful, probably just trying to get his son to be quiet, maybe holding back some painful emotion of his own, ultimately being truly prophetic, says, in verse 8, "My son, God will provide for himself the lamb for a burnt offering." my son, God will provide for himself the lamb for a burnt offering. So the two of them went on together. Okay. So, they go on, they get to the point, you got to wonder how exactly Abraham, you know, got his son tied up, laid on this altar. That had to, you know, that had to go over poorly, by the way. But he ultimately ties up his son and lays him on the altar. He's got the knife up in the air. He stretched out his hand and took the knife to slay his son. But the angel of the Lord called to heaven and said, "Abraham, Abraham." So he said, "Here I am. Do not lay your hand on the lad or anything to harm him, for I know that you fear God, since you have not withheld your son, your only son, from me." Then Abraham lifted his eyes and looked, and there behind him was a ram caught in a thicket by its horns. So Abraham went and took the ram and offered it up for a burnt offering instead of his son. Okay, so, see there, in that moment, God provided a ram. Now, if you are good, solid, asphalt under your feet city folk like I am, you may not know the distinction. But a lamb is essentially a young sheep. And a ram is an older male sheep. Okay, so, those are things that you look up when you're trying to talk about these things. I didn't know that. Frankly, I can hardly tell the difference between a sheep and a goat myself. These are the things that you learn when you're on a farm on vacation, and you're like, oh, that must be the old goat. No, that's a sheep. Looks like a goat. But yes, the difference here is that this whole trip up, they've been talking about there's going to be a child that's going to be sacrificed. We're going to sacrifice a lamb, a young sheep. But when they get there, God provides a ram, an adult male. And they sacrifice the adult male. Now, by the way, this is on a place called Mount Moriah. Now, if you want to do a nice, not really intensive, got to do a little bit of study, hop around about 4 or 5 different places, you can do your studies and find that Mount Moriah is Jerusalem. It's been, several hundred years between the time that Abraham is there and the time that David takes over. David took over in roughly 1000 BC, and of course, Jesus died in roughly 32 AD. So you're talking about 1400 years. Maybe a little more. Names change between then. Look at a map of Europe from 1400 years ago. Okay? They barely called it Europe. Mount Moriah from 1400 years was not still called the same thing. So, when Abraham went to sacrifice Isaac on Mount Moriah, it's the same place that Jesus ended up being sacrificed at. It's the same place that God provided the sacrifice. The adult male, not the child. And as Abraham lifted his eyes, he found the ram. And Abraham called the name of the place, "The Lord will provide." And it is said to this day, "In the mountain of the Lord it shall be provided." Now the Lord will provide. I'm sure you've heard this before. People always say, this is Jehovah Jireh, right? Jehovah Jireh, my provider. His grace is, yeah, Kevin's guy. I refer to this as polka praise. There are people from back in the day who are like, I love that song. Yeah. Oh, how can I get through this as quickly and painlessly as possible? Okay, the word Jehovah never appears in the Bible, okay? Some German monks made it up in like the 14th century, okay? The Jews had a name for God, which he revealed to Moses, that was four letters. It was YHWH. We say Yahweh, okay? The problem was the Jews thought the name of God was too holy to ever say, so they never put any vowels with it. So we say Yahweh, okay? But they never did, okay? When they got to the name of the Lord, they had a hand signal for it because they didn't want to ever say the name of the Lord because it was too holy to say. You know that, thou shalt not take the name of the Lord in vain? They didn't want to ever get anywhere near it. So when they got to the name of the Lord, they went, yeah, name of the Lord, okay? Which kind of looks like the Jewish letter Shem, which is the first letter of the word, the name, okay? So they made that symbol, okay? Now, years later, some German monks took the letters for Yahweh and the vowels for Adonai, which is the Hebrew word for Lord, and they took the vowels for Adonai and the consonants for Yahweh, and they mashed them all together, and they said it in German, and that's how you get Jehovah. Okay? So, that's your, like, messed up history lesson for the day. As quickly and painlessly as possible. Okay? So, when you see, or whenever you hear somebody talk about Jehovah, it's kind of this, like, mixed up, bad church history word. Okay? And what it really means is the name of God. Okay? Jehovah is like, we don't like that word, so we're going to kind of mush up two words together and come up with a word we can say. That's this mix between the name of God and the Lord. Okay? But really, the name of God, when Moses said, who should I say sent me? God said, I am. Right? Now the Jews, when they got to his name, they said, the Lord. Because they didn't want to, you know, accidentally say the name of the Lord and end up, you know, blaspheming and get stoned to death. But when asked, who should I say sent me? The Lord said, I am who I am. So if you look at this, the name of the place is called I Am Will Provide, or I Am Provision. I am your provision. Okay? Now, so, flash forward all these 1,400 years later, to Jesus there. Jesus is getting ready to be sacrificed on the same mountain where Abraham almost sacrificed his son. God is getting ready to go through with what he didn't let Abraham go through with. Abraham had the knife in the air and was ready to bring it down and stopped because God said, stop. I will provide the lamb. And he gave the ram. In the same mountain, God is getting ready to provide the sacrifice. And he's getting ready to provide his own son. But those people who are there with him don't see him like that. They see him as rabbi. They see him as their teacher, their friend, their mentor, this miracle worker. I think that just for a moment, God wanted them to see something else. Because there was a cloud that came and overshadowed them. I think that was the glory of God. The same cloud that descended upon Mount Sinai in Egypt. And a voice came out of the cloud, probably the same voice that thundered on Sinai and spoke to Moses. But this voice says, "This is my beloved son. Hear him." Let me ask you a question. It's an awkward question. Have you ever seen an ugly baby? You have. I know. We all have. And there's a problem with that. You know what the problem is? Most of the time, the parents don't know they have an ugly baby. It's true. Because there's something about being a parent that lets you see your child in an incredibly loving way that filters out all sorts of flaws. And everybody that's a parent knows what I'm talking about, and everybody that's ever seen an ugly baby, and parents who are like, "Isn't my baby awesome?" knows what I'm talking about too. I think that just for a moment, on the Mount of the Transfiguration, God was saying, "You three, I'm getting ready to sacrifice my son. This is how I see him." You see him as a friend. You see him as a teacher, a mentor, a rabbi, maybe even Lord. This is my beloved son. This is how I see him. Glorious and shining in white. This is what this will cost. This is what this will mean to me. This is what I do. And this is what it means that I will provide on this mountain. This is what it means that I will provide for you on this mountain. Now go with me to Romans chapter 8. Paul sums this all up very tightly here. He says, "What then shall we say to these things? If God is for us, who can be against us? He who did not spare his own son, but delivered him up for us all, how shall he not with us also freely give us all things? Who shall bring a charge against God's elect? It is God who justifies. Who is it who condemns? It is Christ who died, and furthermore is also risen, who is even at the right hand of God, who also makes intercession for us. If God would lay down his only son, his beloved son, the son who he always saw shining in glory, not the one with dirty feet and messy hair and spinach in his teeth and smelling like he'd been walking down Jerusalem roads for 6 weeks, but the one shining in glory whose clothes were white as snow and eyes as bright as fire. If he would sacrifice him because he loved us, not when we were shouting hallelujah, but when we were shouting crucify him, this is how we know he loves us. While we were yet sinners, he sent his son to die for us. Then what will he hold back from us? What can we not accomplish in his name? Death, where is thy sting? What? What can we not overcome? What can we not accomplish? What have we to fear? God, who always saw his son 1,000 times more glorious than we see our children, sacrificed his son for a world full of murderous rebels that they might turn their hearts to him and love him, or might reject him completely, and gave them the choice to do that. But he will hold nothing back from us. And all that he asks us in return is that we love him and share that love with everyone else that we have an opportunity to. And every day he continues to give himself to us and continues to give us the opportunity to share that love with others, so that they can know how awesome he is. And that's all that he wants, is that we share his love with others. And that's all he's ever wanted, is to share his love. In the name of the Father, and of the Son, and of the Holy Spirit. Amen. So, with that in mind, please stand and let us affirm together the ancient creed of the church, the Nicene Creed.